got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubles behind. I got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the program. Skeptics of genetically modified food have long argued that Monsanto and other big biotechnology firms are engaged in a conspiracy to fool the public. These evil corporations, so the story goes, pay corrupt scientists to cover up the environmental and health hazards posed by modern agriculture. But what if the situation weren't so simple? Evidence is building that these same GMO skeptics are the ones actually paying experts to deny science and then lying about it after the fact. Science writer John Entin joins me today to discuss a particularly egregious example of this hypocrisy at the International Agency for Research on Cancer. John is the founder of the Genetic Literacy Project and the author of two best-selling books on genetics. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and the Washington Post. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks for listening. John, thank you for joining me. And just for the uninitiated, before we get into the controversy, can you explain what glyphosate is and what it does, and then why there's some people in the environmentalist movement who are so scared of it?
Sure. Glyphosate is an herbicide. It's been around for about 40 years, and it's intriguing because it's been called almost a miracle weed killer. Because it is so toxicologically mild. It has a what's called an LD50 rating, which is an analysis done by testing chemicals on rats and seeing what percentage of them die. About the level of salt, it's just not very hazardous to use. You don't have to use it with hazmat suits or that kind of protection. It's been used in gardens safely. And in the 1990s, some of the large agribusiness companies decided, because it was so successful as a weed killer, if they paired it with genetically modified crops, you could create what would be called herbicide-resistant crops. In other words, they were resistant to being sprayed. The crop themselves was resistant to being sprayed by glyphosate. But the crop itself thrived, and it really is what touched off the GMO revolution. And it's been an amazingly successful product. And because of that, and because the safety of GMOs has now been clearly proven in the public forum, anti-GMO activists have targeted glyphosate almost as a proxy for going after GMO foods, which they are dedicated to trying to remove.
So you kind of touched on this a little bit, but as far as the scientific community is concerned, glyphosate and then these glyphosate resistant crops are safe for consumption, and you know, nobody's fallen over dead from these.
Well, it's not even remotely controversial in the science, mainstream science community. Regulators from every country have looked at this. The EPA has issued over 1,000-page report on this just a couple of years ago. The European Food Safety Authority, Health Canada, Australian agencies, three agencies of the World Health Organization. There's been over 30 reviews across Europe and Asia and North America. Every single one has concluded that glyphosate is not only safe, it's actually extremely mild relative to other herbicides. And it's allowed, with its introduction, with pairing with GMO crops in the 1990s, it's allowed for a dramatic reduction in the toxicity of chemicals sprayed on crops. The problem is that there is one organization that 2 years ago issued a declaration that glyphosate might be carcinogenic. And we can talk about that controversy if you want, but there is that one outlier agency, and that agency really has created the controversy that anti-GMO activists have ridden in their desire to, you know, attack GMOs and modern agriculture.
Let's get into that. So you're talking about the International Agency for Research on Cancer, and they're, like you said, the only organization, any scientific body, I suppose, that thinks there's any problem with this. And before we get too deep into it, can you explain the difference between a hazard assessment and a risk assessment? Excuse me. Because they issued the former, and they're slightly different things. So can you explain what that is?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah. All the agencies that I referred to, European Commission, German Risk Assessment Association, they all look at, is something likely to cause cancer? That's what we really care about. If a farmer is spraying it, is he likely to get cancer? If there's tiny bits of glyphosate residue that might be on fruits or vegetables and might be washed off or not, what's the likelihood that someone is going to get cancer? That's what we really care about. IARC is a different kind of agency. It looks at, can something cause cancer? Well, they have looked at over 1,000 products or even activities, and they've concluded all but one cause cancer. So under their conclusions, sunshine can cause cancer, and it can. I mean, if you're exposed to it at a long enough time, alcohol can cause cancer. Eating certain kinds of meat can cause cancer. Eating certain kinds of vegetables can cause cancer. There's a range of literally 1,000 things that they've looked at. Only once have they ever determined that something does not is not likely to cause cancer. And so glyphosate, just like sunshine, sure, it can cause cancer. But is it likely to cause cancer? The agencies that we talked about, the ones that regulate, they say no, not as it's used today. It's not even remotely. It's not carcinogenic. It's not genotoxic, meaning it's not likely to cause any genetic damage. It doesn't stay long in the soil. It is literally, from an agricultural point of view and a human health and ecological perspective, a miracle a chemical. But this one agency says, yes, it might cause cancer. And that opened the door for activists to take this, what's called a hazard assessment. Again, it's not what regulators use. Regulators use a risk assessment. Hazard assessment has been used to create a scare and create a litigation machine where now people are suing Monsanto, which makes the Roundup Ready crops, which incorporate herbicide resistance, claiming that they got cancer because of the use of glyphosate. No proven link to it. It's just a possible association.
And we're going to get into that definitely. But before we go further, I want people to know. So you said sunshine. IARC has also said mobile phones, wood dust, coffee, working as a hairdresser, night shifts, and hot yerba mate tea all are in the same category as glyphosate. So if you consume or use any of those products, everybody out there, that's what the level of danger you're dealing with is coffee. So unless you're
gonna... it's really absurd when you think about it, because the agency was created many, many years ago, decades ago, when the understanding of risk and hazard was not as clear as it is now. We really don't care if something can cause cancer, because we really pretty much know that most chemicals in one form, natural or not, can cause cancer. It's all about the dose. It's all about the exposure, all about the time of exposure. So the real issue is, what does it do in the real world? And we deal with chemicals all the time. I mean, organic chemicals are present in organic foods use chemicals as much as conventional farmers. They're just natural, but they aren't necessarily safer. So the real issue is, what's the likelihood that it will cause cancer? And in the case of glyphosate, every agency that's looked at this, looked at the risk that people face, said it's safe.
It's a very important fact to keep in mind. And speaking of activists, like you mentioned, it seems that IARC has a soft spot for these people. And I think that's a good transition into the controversy that came out. I believe it was just last week. David Zarek put up a blog post, and he's an environmental health risk analyst, I think is his specialty. But he put out a blog post about one of the experts involved in this IARC research process. So can you sum up that for anyone who isn't aware?
Sure. Actually, what he did was he took documents that were posted on the internet by the U.S. Activist group called U.S. Right to Know, which has been attacking scientists and has been working with the plaintiffs to try to leverage the glyphosate issue into a huge payday for ambulance-chasing lawyers in California. And so they posted what was a deposition of a guy named Chris Portier. Chris Portier is a former consultant with the Environmental Defense Fund. He's actually a statistician. He's not an epidemiologist. He's not an expert in glyphosate, knew nothing about it. But he was the one who went to IARC. Again, this is the UN agency. It's not funded by the UN. It's actually funded by countries around the world. It's a sub-agency who itself, the World Health Organization, has looked at glyphosate. Three different WHO agencies have looked at glyphosate and said it's not carcinogenic. They looked at risk factors. IARC looks, again, at hazard factors. Chris Portier went to IARC because he knew that their standards for calling something cancerous were so low. And proposed that they look at this weed killer, and he had already been in contact with the lawyers in California, who were preparing litigation in the glyphosate case, and he secretly agreed to a contract where he would be paid as a consultant, while at the same time he was guiding IARC to its decision, no surprise, that glyphosate might cause cancer.
And you mentioned a few key facts there, but just to fill in some detail. So he was working with attorneys before IARC published this review, I guess. They were paying him $450 an hour as an expert consultant. And go ahead.
He had not signed the contract at that point. He was actually looking to them. But as soon as the IARC ruling came out, he signed a contract with two litigation firms in California, where he would essentially look over documents and give them expert guidance on, how they should proceed in their litigation. But what was so intriguing about it is that he also agreed that he would not disclose publicly that there was a conflict of interest. And he traveled around the world, including lobbying in the European Parliament, which is now deciding whether they're going to reauthorize glyphosate to be used by European farmers, claiming that he was just an independent scientist who, out of his conscience, came to these understandings that glyphosate was dangerous. And it was never revealed that he was making $450 an hour working for plaintiffs who stand to make millions, hundreds of millions of dollars if they get this case to stick.
So you mean he's not just a humanitarian? He's actually so this obviously, I mean, not for everyone, but you and I know this is a great example of hypocrisy, because the critics of conventional agriculture, of biotechnology, the linchpin of their conspiracy theory is that companies like Monsanto are buying off science, and they're trying to fool people into thinking, this herbicide is safe, these crops are safe. But this is exactly what they're accusing other people of. And Portier has an activist background, like you said. So what does this situation reveal about these critics?
Well, it's actually much different in fundamental ways from what they claim Monsanto is doing. What they claim, without any evidence, is that somehow Monsanto has infiltrated the EPA, the European Food Safety Authority, the German Risk Assessment, Health Canada, the Australian agency that overlooks it, the Japanese agency that overlooks these issues, somehow secretly taken over those agencies and corrupted the process in more than 40 regulatory agencies around the world, and gotten them to somehow whitewash the fact that glyphosate is a dangerous carcinogen. In this case, there's no evidence, of course, of that at all, and it's absurd on the basis. Anyone who would look at it just at face value. What he's done is something far more nefarious. He is someone who has no expertise in this area at all. He has he specifically went to an agency that he knew because it had never essentially looked at any product and not ruled, except in one case, and not ruled that it was a potential carcinogen, that he could get a ruling that would essentially open the litigation doors. I'm not so sure he's doing it only to feather his wealth nest. That may be a motivation. People like him are really true believers. They are activists. My sense of Chris Portier is that he believes in his heart that farming, modern farming, is corrupt, and that Monsanto is controlling the world food supply, and that they literally have infiltrated every major regulatory agency in the world. I grew up incredibly skeptical of corporations. I maintain that viewpoint. We all should be skeptical of big anything, big business, big NGOs. But that kind of conspiracy thinking is almost beyond the pale.
Yeah, it's atrocious, I think. And I just thought of something. From my understanding, academia typically leans to the left, and that's true even in the sciences. And so the fact that you have all of these government agencies, all these expert panels coming out and going, no, you know, Monsanto really isn't trying to poison people. There's no evidence of that. That's kind of a hostile witness in a way, because these people don't like corporations either, really. And so the fact that you have these people, these true believers, as you describe them, on the far outside, I mean, that shows you, I mean, how out in left field these people really are.
Yeah, they're really out of the mainstream. But the media, I hate to rail against the mainstream media, David Zarek's piece, and he's a bit of a crusading journalist. I have a lot of admiration for him. He's taken a lot of personal abuse, and he gets it every single day. Should have been on the front page of the New York Times, and it should be today. This is really an epic scandal. California, everyone knows about Prop 65 and how they regulate chemicals there, and they have warnings about all kinds of things, and they're the only state that has this kind of rigid system where they put warnings. You walk into Walt Disney World and it warns that it's a cancer haven. I mean, there's a Prop 65 statement when you walk in. That's how out of kilter it's gotten in California. Essentially, they went to California, IARC, Chris Portier from IARC went to California, and California uses IARC as its basis for a lot of its Prop 65 rulings, and they were able to get California to say it's carcinogenic, saying that, again, it's possibly could cause cancer, not that it does cause cancer, but that's how Prop 65 is worded, and that's enough to scare people, and that's enough to, I think, it might be possible enough to scare a jury to come down with a ruling costing hundreds of millions of dollars that would put one of the most revolutionary weed killers, one of the safest weed killers, out of business. And what would happen immediately after glyphosate was banned? You'd go back to using old line herbicides that are far more toxic, and it would be an ecological, literally an ecological disaster of epic proportion. But I think at this point the hate by activists of large corporations, and they're willing to distort things because of their conspiracy thinking, is so grotesque that they're willing to actually sacrifice the environment for their ideological purposes.
And you're starting to see a little bit of splintering, actually, because even Charles Benbrook, who's one of their, you know, their experts for hire, even he's admitted in multiple places now that he doesn't want to ban glyphosate because of what you just said. They're, you know, we're going to go to older pesticides that are more toxic, and then you potentially could have a real problem because you're going to worse chemicals. And so that's something important for people to know, I think.
Yeah, I said the real scientists. There are a lot of sincere scientists who are concerned about aspects of modern agriculture. I mean, it is not free of corporate influence in certain ways, and there are issues about monoculture and large corporate farms that are worth debating. I think there's fascinating points of view on both sides. So when you even Charles Brenbrook, though, as you said, who is a he's an economist, actually, not a scientist. He's an agricultural economist, but he's been widely quoted because of his so-called expertise in scientific issues. And he's actually been on the pay of the organic industry, interestingly enough, for about the last 10 years or so. But he has enough credibility and academic integrity that he said, yeah, I mean, if glyphosate goes, we're going to turn to atrazine. We're going to turn to a whole wide range of other chemicals that were phased out in the 1990s when glyphosate became, you know, widely used as a weed killer.
And the second part of the scandal that just came out yesterday, I think, in a Reuters report is that IARC edited the final draft of the monograph that they released, and they were excluding research that didn't fit the conclusion that they wanted. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, this is a tough one. There's a Reuters reporter named Kate Kellen. She's superb. She's based in London. And what she reported is that IARC dismissed and edited findings from a draft of its review of the weed killer that were at odds with its final conclusion. In other words, during the draft process, there were at least 10 instances, and she didn't get a look at the entire document. She got a look at just one section of it. So there really could be dozens or even hundreds of instances. But in the section that she looked at, there were 10 instances in which in the draft report, the scientists had concluded that there was that the science studies that they were citing had concluded that there was no problem from glyphosate, that it was not carcinogenic, that yet when you saw the final version, the one that was published, in every one of those cases, those references had either been deleted or it had been softened and said, well, they didn't have enough information to reach a final determination. Now, you know, so is it a scandal? Well, there's always going to be changes between a draft report and a final report. So I would give some leeway to believe that, but it's hard to believe that every single one of the changes went from non-carcinogenic to either being deleted entirely or to soften it to say that there wasn't enough information. So it sure hints, it sure smells bad. And IARC is just shutting its doors and saying, we're not going to release any of the other draft information. So we're not going to allow any transparency. And yet they claim they're one of the most transparent regulatory oversight agencies in the world.
Well, again, I mean, that the hypocrisy is astounding, because their complaint is that the industry, the biotech industry is doing all this stuff in secret and they're poisoning people. And yet here they are being called to account. They're going, oh, we're not going to release anything. I just find that remarkable, really.
It is. I mean, there could literally be dozens or hundreds of cases in which they altered the final report, and they all could be in the same direction, from something that suggested that glyphosate was relatively harmless and clearly safe, to something that suggested that it could be dangerous. And the fact that this had to be done by someone, right? There is a guiding force behind this. Was this Chris Portier, the same person who brought the idea of even looking at glyphosate? Was it done by a consortium of people inside? This needs to be known. And yet here we have the European Parliament, as early as next week, going to rule on whether glyphosate is going to be reauthorized. And if they pull it from the market as of January 1st, 2018, because they don't reauthorize it, that's going to affect the livelihoods of tens of thousands of farmers in Europe, and set a cascading series of events that's going to be catastrophic, I think, around the world. It's going to hurt farmers. It's going to hurt consumers. And suddenly we're going to have this flood of dangerous chemicals coming in based on a flawed report from a flawed agency. The hypocrisy is really astounding.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And I want to discuss just a few of the implications. But first, even the farmers in the European Union, particularly in France, are very vocal about how opposed they are to this. And they mentioned a few of the things we talked about, that it's going to raise the cost of their inputs, they're going to use more dangerous pesticides. So it's not just the big agrochemical companies that are opposed to this. It's people that go out there and produce food for us every day who are going, you guys are going to make our jobs so much harder. What do you think is going to happen in terms of maybe food availability or food prices? I mean, how is this going to affect the economics of agriculture if it goes into effect?
Well, let me just say, I run this a website called the Genetic Literacy Project, which is a nonprofit We get no industry funding. We're very transparent. Our disclosure statement is on our website, and people can download our tax filings with the IRS that shows that we're an independent nonprofit. We've had a lot of articles written by farmers talking about why they use glyphosate. And they use it because it's safer for them. They talk about how dangerous it was as a farmer using much more toxic chemicals until glyphosate came along, and why they it's actually in many ways really good for the environment, because we don't have to do tilling of crops. And when you do tilling of crops, you release carbon into the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas emission problem. So there's a cascading series of consequences if you ban glyphosate. One, as you mentioned, the inputs are going to be higher. Glyphosate is ridiculously cheap. It's off patent. Monsanto is only one of 17 manufacturers that make it right now. Farmers can buy it from anybody, and it's as cheap as possibly could be. It's readily available. It's much safer. How will it change the dynamics and economics? That's hard to tell. You can replace it with something else, but what you're going to have is a less safe food system. You're going to have farmers with more health problems. But the real, I think, implications are going to come in the developing world. Glyphosate is widely used around the world. And when Europe starts banning something like that, African countries, Asian countries who don't have a sophisticated science infrastructure say, oh my God, what does Europe know that we don't know? They're going to start banning it as well. The toxic implications on small farmers in Africa who don't have the protective gear and the money and the range of other ways to guide their agricultural practices, it's going to be catastrophic. So, you know, you'll absolutely see some changes in prices, but the health consequences of this for farmers and consumers, I think, are pretty scary. And what it also means is that there are going to be other targets. This is a tactic which is being used to go after modern agricultural chemicals. Chemicals are crop protection. No one wants to use chemicals. Organic farmers use it all the time. They use chemicals as much as conventional farmers. The question is, what's the toxicity? What's their potential danger? If we start scaring people about chemical usage, it's going to spread to the organic movement as well, and we're not going to be able to feed the global population, which is going to be pushing 10 billion by 2050.
Something tells me that if and when that comes to pass, and hopefully it won't because of the work that people like you are doing, but if it does come to pass, something tells me they're not going to stand up and go, oh, you know, we were wrong about this, you know, our bad. They're going to blame it on industry, and they're going to blame it on governments, you know, for not being prepared. Because they've already made those kind of arguments where, on the one hand, they say that, you know, biotechnology doesn't do anything, but then they go into the field and rip up the plants that people are trying to test. So it's like these people are very cynical, and I think they're very politically motivated. So they're not honest. And so I'm hoping, you know, that what you're describing doesn't happen.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, glyphosate is a fascinating kind of test case, because there is such a voluminous evidence of its safety. It's not one of those things that's kind of like, they can rule either way if they look at the science. It's absolutely clear. You have one hazard-based agency stacked up against 30-plus risk-based agencies, including the EPA and European Food Safety Authority and the European Commission. This is not a close call here. And if it can happen with glyphosate, there are other chemicals that we use that are closer calls, that are controversial. And in every time you use a chemical in farming, you do a risk assessment. What are the risks? What are the benefits? There's always consequences when you use pesticides, when you use herbicides. The question is, are the risks worth the benefits? In glyphosate, I think that there's no question that the benefits are enormous. There are other ones that are, it's going to be dicier. And I think there's going to be a series of other attacks on other chemicals as well, many of which used appropriately are really important for modern agriculture and have been a key factor in keeping food prices low and food abundant and extremely safe in the United States, at least.
I've had Kevin Folth on the program. I've had Cami Ryan, Allison Van Inenum, and all three of them are more or less optimistic about the future because they're getting out there and they're talking to the public and they're trying to avoid the issue with, you know, just citing statistics to people. They're trying to tell stories and identify the pain that people might be feeling in relation to these issues and then turn the tide. Do you think that's going to be effective in kind of winning the public over?
Well, I think the in the long term, I'm optimistic as well, because I think the technologies are there, especially in revolution in gene editing, CRISPR, which we see, which avoid some of these problems that are faced with GMOs and even with pesticides. Potentially, we can talk about that. I think the technology over time will win out, but I'm not so optimistic in the short and medium term. I think that the ability to scare people is an art form, and I think a lot of NGOs, from Greenpeace to Center for Food Safety to the Environmental Working Group, have really mastered that. And having scientists as eminent as the ones that you mentioned out in the, on the hustings and campaigning for a fair hearing for modern agriculture is not going to be enough when you have NGOs that are expert at manipulating information on the web and creating scare tactics. So I'm not as optimistic as they are.
Well, the problem is like you said, these people have dedicated their lives to scholarship and really understanding the science. But then you go up against these groups who are brilliant salespeople, I have to say, as someone with a background in sales. These guys are good because they identify the things that people care about, and then they manipulate those issues to get what they want. And it's very effective. So maybe we just have to keep working on our communication skills and how we're presenting these issues so people really understand what's going on.
Well, again, people just – the whole idea of risk really – confounds people. I mean, you can be a mom and say, I understand that the European Food Safety Authority and the German Risk Association has said that it's glyphosate is not dangerous. But you know something? I have a 6-month-old baby. It's just not worth the risk for me. I'm willing to pay twice as much and buy organic food that doesn't have glyphosate. It might be filled with E. coli because or listeria because of organic food practices, and people die from listeria and E. coli every year. No one gets sick from glyphosate. But that's the way people make decisions. They don't make rational decisions because they don't have it's hard for the brain to wrap itself around risk when you're personally involved. There's plenty of examples outside of the glyphosate debate that people don't process risk very well, and they will make irrational choices. So I wish communications alone could win this war. I just think that technology over time will outlast the critics. Back in the early 1800s, when the Industrial Revolution was starting, there was a lot of opposition to that as well. There was a group of religious what we now think of them as religious fanatics who came known to be Luddites in England, who opposed technology. They considered themselves the progressives of this era. They would be the NRDC. They would be the Environmental Working Group. They would be the Center for Food Safety. The Luddites are what they were, what they are today. And they considered themselves in opposition to technology in the early 1800s as progressives, and they believed that factories were a bad thing. And there were some negatives that went along with industrialization that caused a lot of pain. But in the long run, we know that that industrialization and modernization has transformed the world and made it much safer. So people today still refer to Ludditism as an example of people who are against progress. But they don't recognize that the people at that time thought of themselves as the progressives. They thought of themselves as the ones who were protecting the people. And that's what we have now. We have a delusory group of activists who actually believe that they're on the side of good when I think history will treat them very, very, very badly.
So the technology, metaphorically speaking, is just going to run them over. They're not going to be able to deny the impact of it given enough time. Sounds like that's how.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it may take much longer. Look, it took 17 years to get Aqua Bounty before Aqua Bounty was able to get the genetically modified salmon approved. And all it does is grow twice as fast. That's the only distinction between that and the regular salmon out there. And it's still being blocked because one senator, Lisa Murkowski, has managed to delay it. In the United States, but it is being sold in Canada, and it might be sold in other countries as well. 17 years. I mean, so you can delay things, but eventually science is going to win out on these kinds of things. I'm very, very hopeful. Gene editing involves different kinds of practices that are different from genetic engineering using transgenics, where you move genes from one species to another, and I think it it will not face the kind of opposition that NGOs have been able to marshal against modern biotechnology as it exists today.
Well, that's a pretty positive note to end on. So just to wrap up, tell people a little bit more about Genetic Literacy Project, and then give a plug for that book you wrote a few years ago. I think it's called Let Them Eat Precaution.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, the Genetic Literacy Project has been in existence since 2012. I've written two books on population genetics that were very controversial bestsellers, Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It, and Abraham's Children, Race Identity and the DNA of the Chosen People. And I was very interested in the controversies involving things such as gene therapy, mitochondrial replacement, designer babies. And many of the issues that are swirling around GMOs also swirl around human genetics. And I also wrote a book, as you mentioned, called Let Them Eat Precaution, about the controversy over GMOs. And both of those areas I thought provided, there was a need to really address the misinformation that was going around about that. And I approached a couple of foundations and we launched the Genetic Literacy Project, and now we get anywhere from 15,000 to 20,000 visitors a day. And we have articles from around the web and original articles that we have scientists and journalists write. I'm really trying to address these kinds of controversies that we're talking about today. Are chemicals harmful? When can they be safely used? When they can not be safely used? What kind of human genetic practices are ones that we might want to debate for ethical or religious reasons or scientific concerns? So these are very, very, very hot topics. They're important. People with differing points of view, but honest brokers of information, sometimes come down on different sides of these issues. And we want to be a forum and have developed as a forum where people can literally discuss different perspectives on biotechnology, genetics, farming, and a range of other issues.
Very good. Well, we'll link to GLP and then your books so people can buy them off Amazon and get a little more educated about this stuff. But, John, thanks so much for chatting with me, and we'll hope to have you back in the future.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.